Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock. This week, two stories. First, Greenland. With the White House ramping up its hostile takeover rhetoric, is this the issue that could spell the end of NATO? Then, lights out in Berlin, how a far-left terrorist group caused a five-day power outage in Germany's capital. Or did it?
Is it Russians using the name of this group to continue to sow destabilisation? Or is it just a split within the Volkan Gruppe, the left-wing group? Remember, authorities say it's not one individual, it's a collective.
Those stories coming up here on Inside Europe.
We need Greenland from a national security situation. It's so strategic. Right now, Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships all over the place. We need Greenland from the standpoint of national security. And Denmark is not going to be able to do it, I can tell you.
The 45th and 47th President of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump, there, telling reporters that the US needs Greenland. And whilst the White House has said that it is actively discussing a potential offer to buy the Danish autonomous territory, it has also made clear that, quote, utilising the US military is always an option at the commander-in-chief's disposal. It's a threat that European leaders are taking very seriously indeed, coming as it does hot on the heels of the US's military attack on Venezuela and the abduction of its president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Xenia Flores. But would the United States really attack a fellow NATO member? With President Trump now openly invoking what has been termed the Donroe Doctrine, his own personal iteration of a vision of US military-backed hemispheric dominance, our security correspondent Terry Schultz reports that the European security community is increasingly having to contemplate a scenario which, until recently, would simply have been unimaginable.
NATO has hundreds of pages of military plans detailing how to protect itself against attack, but the scenarios always envision an external adversary. There's no playbook on how to handle President Trump's ramped-up threats to take over the territory of one of his allies. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen says this would be the end of NATO.
First, we should take the US president seriously when he says he wants Greenland. But I also want to make it clear that if the United States decides to militarily attack another NATO country, then everything would stop. That includes NATO and therefore post-World War II security.
But even short of, or perhaps ahead of, any military movements, the impact of the escalating rhetoric alone cannot be underestimated, says Patrick Oksanen, a senior fellow at the Stockholm Free World Forum.
It is a huge victory for Putin that we're even having this discussion. The way that things are developing now is the dream of Soviet Union leaders who wanted NATO to crumble for many, many decades. We are taking it quite seriously here up in High North.
Ed Arnold of the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, himself a former official at NATO's military headquarters, says especially the notion of having consultations about the dispute among NATO ambassadors would be very damaging.
The narrative and optics of it would look pretty poor, because effectively it would then be 32 allies all sitting around a table, and sort of the principal challenge and threat being from around the table. I mean, this is exactly what Putin wants. Putin knows that he can't defeat NATO militarily, but he can defeat it politically, and he hopes to defeat it politically. But even Putin doesn't have this sort of in terms of sort of political disruption into the alliance.
Some observers have suggested a solution could be for NATO's European allies to send troops to Greenland to show Trump they're taking its defense seriously, and that any unilateral deployment from the U.S. would be unnecessary. Director of the European Union's Institute for Security Studies, Stephen Everts, says there could be value in that, but only for the right reasons.
You know, yes, Europeans ought to be taking Arctic security seriously. And if there are gaps, then we should try to fill them. And we should, you know, substantiate our commitment to Greenland and Arctic security, not just with better words, but also deployment of resources, including military. But don't present this as in, okay, and then Trump will leave us alone. Because I don't think that works.
Anders Vistisen, a Danish member of the European Parliament, agrees with Everts that Europe should not be looking for a solution that placates Trump and instead should be making their own position crystal clear.
Now we are at a point that is so serious that there can be no room for doubt or any maneuverability within our communication with the United States. The only way that the U.S. will get any headway in Greenland is if we allow them to sow internal division within the Kingdom of Denmark. And therefore, we should have a very strong and very clear rebuttal and say to the American administration and President Trump, no, you're not going to have any claim in Greenland. You're not going to persuade us, push us, bully us into acting any differently within our internal organization of the Kingdom of Denmark and the self-governing territories of Greenland and the Faroe Islands.
Vistisen went viral a year ago when he used a profanity in telling Trump what he could do with his intent to buy Greenland. Vistisen tells DW he's promised not to repeat the phrase publicly, but he stands by the sentiment and his tactic to use frank language to convey to Washington the unacceptability of its position. One of Vistisen's colleagues, Per Clausen of the Left Group, believes it's the other side of Brussels that may hold the power to impact this situation. Clausen is proposing that as long as Trump is threatening Greenland, the European Parliament should suspend its debate on approving the transatlantic trade deal. That's the agreement with the Trump administration on tariffs, widely seen to favor the U.S.
We have a lot of things you could do that could harm U.S. very much if you're talking about the economy in the United States. And I think we should make it totally clear for the United States that we want to use this weapon if the United States don't stop with aggression.
Clausen says he hopes his proposal will gain enough political weight to make the U.S. see that Denmark is not isolated in this situation and that European leaders are not only talking about the solidarity with Denmark and Greenland, but are also willing to act. Patrick Oksanen says the severity of the situation deserves that and more. If the U.S. forces its way into Greenland, he says, it wouldn't be just the end of NATO, but the end of time as we know it. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
For the latest European security developments, you can follow Terry on socials or download DW's Breaking World News app. We are keen to feature Greenlandic voices on the programme in the coming weeks. So if that's you, or if you'd like to suggest someone that you think we should be talking to, then please do get in touch via insideeurope@dw.com. You can also leave us a voice note by going to www.speakpipe.com/DW Inside Europe. It's a super easy to use interface. All you have to do is click on the microphone bar to record your message. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
When headlines get louder,
we go deeper.
Say hello to Berlin Briefing,
your guide to Germany's impact on the world.
Between East and West, autocrats and democrats, Germany's whole system is under stress.
Pressure from all sides.
And the world around Germany is getting more dangerous.
Is democracy glitching? Too much noise? Too little clarity?
We decode what it means for you.
From Berlin to right where you are.
It's all in Berlin Briefing on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
Our second story this week is closer to home. This week, an arson attack on a cable bridge in the southwest of Germany's capital, Berlin, cut electricity to some 45,000 households and 2,200 businesses, leaving some 100,000 residents without heat in sub-zero temperatures. Power was only fully restored after 5 days, making it the longest blackout in the city's post-war history. Within hours, a left-wing extremist group had claimed responsibility for the attack, and the authorities still regard that initial claim as credible, although, as we'll be hearing, the narrative has become somewhat more complex as the week has progressed. To take me through the week's events, I am joined by reporter Matt Moore from DW's Hauptstadtstudio in Berlin. Matt, anatomy of a blackout. Can you take me through it? At what moment did Berliners realise that something had gone very wrong?
They first began to realise that something was very, very wrong on Saturday morning, around 6:30 in the morning. The first reports came in to the fire services in the southwest of Berlin that there was a fire reported at a canal side in the southwest. And then quickly, within kind of a matter of minutes, really, it was clear that the company that runs the power grid had reported a major problem there. And so it was clear within the early hours of Saturday morning that thousands of homes had been affected. And so for a lot of the people waking up in those communities, they would wake up, their phones had no signal. People were kind of scratching their heads and they were going out to the streets or going out to their sheds and finding old battery-powered radios to try to find out what had happened. And so that was the first, really, that people realised that something major was up.
What was the atmosphere like? Were people calm?
So I think it was a relative calm, but over the course of the day, it emerged that the power company that was there to fix this massive problem, this fire that had severed basically the cable bridge, it's a cable bridge, it goes over a canal from the power plant to all the substations and the homes in that area, that the repairs were going to take 5 days. Now, that sounds crazy when you kind of think about other attacks and other incidences where, you know, you might have a power outage and homes are back in power after a matter of hours. So 5 days. And I think that's when people realised this was major and it was going to require a huge response, both from the state, but also from each other. And people were going to be relying on help. And I remember, you know, I was on Saturday afternoon. I was with my in-laws, and my mother-in-law asked me, would we take her in if they were affected? Which was when I realised that it was getting very real, because she wasn't affected, but their friends were affected, and they were thinking, okay, what are we going to do? And the question is, where do we sleep? Because it's, you know, the temperatures here in Berlin at the moment are sub-zero during the day and even colder at night, down to kind of minus 10 in some places. So it was the worst possible time for this to happen. So I think people were just wondering, where is the state and where is the help? And of course, there were soup kitchens and gymnasiums and sports halls were turned into centres, but that all took time to kind of get up and running. And, you know, a lot of people who were very, very vulnerable, Kate, were facing a kind of existential moment of crisis. The mayor of Berlin wasn't seen in public on the Saturday, and he was only seen in public on the Sunday. And he visited at one of these kind of Tonhalle, these gymnasiums where very vulnerable old people could go and sleep. And he was addressed in really strong terms by a young, the son basically, who was saying, why are my parents, 85 years old, freezing in this sports hall overnight? What is going on? Where are the hotels? Where's the help? And he was kind of blank-faced and couldn't really say anything. That's the mayor, you know? So it was, of course, when you ask about whether people can, some people were, but obviously some people were really scared and kind of feeling this sense of helplessness.
So lots of questions for the authorities there, Matt, not least, as you say, for Berlin's mayor, Kai Wegner, who, it has emerged, apparently took time out to play tennis whilst the crisis was unfolding. However, Berliners, of course, will have had other very urgent questions in their minds, not least, who has done this, who has attacked our energy supply? And there, at least, the answers seem to come very quickly, because there was the publication of a claim of responsibility by a left-wing extremist group calling themselves the Vulkangruppe or Volcano Group. What can you tell me about this group, and why was it that the authorities regarded these claims as credible?
This group has been around since 2011. Back then, they carried out a kind of attack on an S-Bahn, so train station in eastern Berlin. And then you know, it's interesting to look at, okay, why are they called the Vulcan Group or the Volcano Group? And the name takes its derived from the Icelandic volcano eruption in 2010, which really brought European airspace to a total standstill. Ultimately, the idea, that speaks to the idea that this group had originally, which was to bring society to a standstill. It's, you know, we're talking about anti-capitalist, anti-consumerist ideas, that they felt that society was heading in the wrong direction and it needed moments of uncertainty for people to reevaluate their priorities. And so the domestic intelligence service here in Germany, they say that this is a group that basically is very disparate, hard to kind of find a single leader. And so this group began carrying out these really irregular attacks in the Berlin-Brandenburg region in 2011. And up until now, they've carried out some 13 that the authorities basically hold them responsible for. And these attacks have basically been on pylon stations. There was a similar attack on a power station in Berlin and in another district, which kind of flew under the radar because only 6,000 homes were affected and they managed to repair that within a matter of hours. So we might not even be talking about this had it not been just so damaging to and so difficult to repair.
And in the document that they circulated claiming responsibility, they did reference some of these past attacks. So many reasons for the authorities to take this claim very, very seriously. However, you can probably hear from the caution in my voice, in recent days there has been doubt about the authenticity of those claims, speculation online, and then even another document circulated by a group also claiming to be the Volcano Group, saying, no, this wasn't us. So maybe you could take me through how this narrative has got complicated and what this means for our understanding of what is going on.
You had, in the initial hours after this incident, you had this claim of responsibility that was published. It was initially sent to some media outlets and then they published it online, and they published these claims of responsibility saying, look, we're basically turning off the power. For those in power, you know, the area that they targeted is in the southwest of Berlin, very affluent area, big villas, well-heeled people live there. Then you had the reaction and the drip of news about just how damaging and how disruptive this had been, this attack had been to that neighbourhood, and the fact that people were freezing, and you would see videos on the news of old people in camper beds, in gymnasiums, in sports halls. And so they issued a follow-up statement where they basically gave a lot of detail about this incident, this attack, how they carried it out, and also appeared somehow apologetic. They said, we kind of are sorry for the less affluent people that were affected by our attack. We have limited sympathy for the villa owners, the rich. We would like people to go and check on their neighbours. So you could sense that there was a slight regret, perhaps, but at least they wanted to kind of to put that out there, that this was not the intention, as they said. The intention was to target the fossil fuel industry and to the power plant. Then a follow-up statement, or rather, before the follow-up statement, you mentioned it, you alluded to it, people started to kind of analyse this statement, linguists and so on, and they queried whether the statement was written by a native German. And they did so because of the syntax and also because of some of the turns of phrases, the fact that political leaders that were mentioned in this really long rambling statement, J.D. Vance, for example, Franziska Giffey, they got the names of these people wrong, people that you would think they would get right. So these people online who were analysing the statement, they think that it maybe had been written in Russian because the syntax was very similar to Russian, so with some of the phrases that were used. Naturally, that in this moment, in this time that we live in, that led to a lot of people saying, hey, maybe this is a false flag operation. You had a senior German lawmaker, someone who was on the Intelligence Oversight Committee, so they have access to a lot of classified information, gave an interview where he said that it should not be ruled out that Russia had a hand in this. So now people are starting to ask, okay, is, you know, anyone can post these claims of responsibility? Is there some sort of hybrid warfare that we're seeing here? A follow-up statement then arrives from the Volkangruppe saying this is not a false flag operation. It's really us. It's no foreign power has any. It's we the left wing group, and we think that we're doing it because of these ideological reasons. So they're okay. People trying to work out who's where the truth lies. At this moment, it's worth saying the authorities are continuing to say we consider this a left wing extremist attack. We do not have reliable evidence for Russian involvement. And then a final statement arrives, which is from the apparently from the founders of the Volkangruppe, the guys that began in 2011, saying, we distance ourselves from these recent attacks that we've seen. In 2011, they said, our motive was to protest against armed deployments abroad. It was about protesting against the military-industrial complex, arms exports. We had to change course because of the Ukraine war. It's quite interesting what they say. They say, basically, we saw that foreign powers were using acts like the ones we were carrying out to sow destabilize society. And that made it difficult for us. We had to change course. So they, in that statement, basically said, you know, hybrid warfare had meant that we were not able to get our message out through those means that we used in the past without it looking like it was a foreign power. And so therefore, we took a step back. So now you're left thinking, okay, is it Russians using the name of this group to continue to sow destabilization? Or is it just a split within the Volkangruppe, the left-wing group? Remember, authorities say it's not one individual. It's a collective. It's people who maybe, you know, are more anti-capitalist. Some are more ecologically motivated. Some are concerned about AI. So at the moment, we're all left scratching our heads. I will say, at the time of recording, the authorities are still saying this is a left-wing extremist attack. The federal prosecutor in Germany is investigating terrorism charges here, and they say there is no reliable evidence that points to Russian involvement.
So what I hear is that we're here at the end of the week. The lights have gone back on, but you're left with a lot of questions. You've got questions on the one hand about the response of the authorities, and you've got questions on the other hand about how this could have happened in the first place. I guess my final question is about answers. What have you learned about Berlin, about Berliners, and about the, not the infrastructural, but maybe the sort of social resilience that we've seen?
Okay, there's two things. I think that you're right about not to talk too much about the infrastructure, but what's really interesting about Berlin is how vulnerable it is. You know, you've got power plants that power communities, and these power plants, basically, they have cable bridges which are overland. People can see them, and these are vulnerable neuralgic points where you can, sensible points which you can target, and you do not need to be highly sophisticated. You can just go there with some petrol and you can cause a whole lot of damage. And so there is a big question about how Germany, how Berlin goes forward and make sure that they can protect those critical points in the future. But I think you also, as you say, Kate, like, these are also moments where people realise, okay, what's important to me? What's important to my community? What do I need to survive? And, you know, as you say, trying to find out, okay, where do I go if I need help? Do I have enough cash on hand? Should I be checking on my older neighbours? Yeah, and I think the pandemic helped with that to some extent, but I think this was a real moment for those Berliners in the Southwest where they realised it's important to just be thinking about these things and having maybe chats with neighbours, and so that in the event of a disaster like that, where you don't have power for several days, you're ready to kind of forge those bonds that will help us get through the test in the coming days.
DW's Matt Moore in Berlin there. We'll be posting a clip from that interview to the DW Podcasts channel on YouTube and also linking to Matt's reporting in our show notes. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Coming up for you this half hour, a selection of place-based stories, including a Ukrainian youth parliamentarian and educational advocate in Scotland, a Byron Museum in Italy, and Greek monks in, well, in Greece, but there is a catch. All will be revealed soon, but first, to Oulu. The northern Finnish port city is one of two European capitals of culture in 2026, the other being Trenčín in Slovakia. We'll have to leave Trenčín to another day, but Oulu, we anticipated. So, without further ado, here is Lars Bavanga's preview of what to expect from the former industrial city on the northernmost shores of the Bothian Sea.
So we'll give you an example of an old Polonaise from these regions.
The Relle Folk Music Group is one of more than 500 cultural organisations and creative professionals contributing to the over 3,000 events during Oulu's year as European Capital of Culture.
Every day there will be different kind of events, and we have some exhibitions which will be open all year long. So you can come to Oulu anytime and be sure that there will be interesting things to experience.
Pia Rantala-Korhonen is the CEO of Oulu 2026.
So how important has it been for you to anchor this in the local community, not just have a cultural program that visitors can come and experience, but actually make it an integrated part of Oulu and the region?
It's essential thing to make European Capital of Culture together with residents and communities and the enterprises, because without having the feeling that we are making this together, we can't engage people emotionally.
The city was once a global manufacturer of tar used on wooden ships, and much later it became one of the main hubs for mobile giant Nokia. Parts of the 2026 culture program will reflect this industrial past. For instance, the abandoned cellulose factory designed in 1931 by world-renowned architect Alvar Aalto, which is being restored and will serve as a venue. But the geopolitical realities in this part of Finland are also represented. Russia, once an occupying force here, is only a few hours' drive east. Ukraine and a possible path to peace is on many people's minds. One of the central art installations during Oulu 2026 is called Layers in the Peace Machine. Through the website peacemachine.eu, audiences around the world can share their own memories related to peace, which artist Ina Tajun-Lahti and Sara Henrika Mekinen then used to create a multimedia installation that will take over much of the Oulu City Hall.
Ja teos tutkii rauhaa jatkuvana vuorovaikutuksellisena.
Sara Henrika Mekinen explains that the installation explores peace as a continuous interactive process, and that she believes artists can help bring about a cultural shift in how we see peace by combining art and technology. Oulu 2026 CEO Pia Rantala-Korhonen agrees.
I think that culture and art can offer people different kind of opportunities to understand the concept of peace and conflicts. And I hope that people will find new ways to understand that we can disagree about many things and still we can live in peace. And we don't have weapons, but we have art and culture, and they bring people together. And when we put different kind of people together, it's a beginning of mutual understanding.
All right, so we are about 30 meters below.
Now, because of Finland's history with Russia, every municipal building and every block of flats around the country is duty-bound by law to have a bomb shelter. This one I'm in right now is one of the largest in the whole of Finland. It's a car park right now, and of course, this is also a space that will be used in 2026.
Artist Jakob Kutz-Steensen will transform this underground architecture into a digital installation. Here's how he explains it in his own words on the Oulu Culture Capital official website.
And inside of there, there'll be different sound, different music, and there'll be this virtual world made with the botanical garden and the rivers and environment surrounding the city. Yeah, some kind of new cultural format coming together here. That's what excites me the most about the Cultural Capital project. It's not just my own artwork and being here, it's also participating and seeing like a whole city become something else.
Some Oulu 2026 events will likely appeal to an even wider audience, like the World Air Guitar Championships in August. I got a demonstration of the art from the 2025 winner, Apu Rautio. Although it doesn't make for great radio, believe me, it's entertaining. But what of the lasting legacy once the European Culture Capital year is over? Well, according to several studies, host cities can expect increases in both visitors' numbers, employment and general GDP growth. Lars Bevanger, DW, in Oulu.
A guitar might not be good for radio, but I'm sure that somewhere there is a DW commissioner itching to grab that idea for TikTok. In the meantime, however, here is a rather more serious youth offering. It's time for the penultimate instalment of producer Laura Kabelka's Age is Just a Number series, profiling the young European voices chosen as youth ambassadors by the One Young World Global Youth Platform. This week, we meet 19-year-old Nazri Lialuk, who arrived in Scotland from Ukraine in April 2022. He is now a member of the Scottish Youth Parliament and a student of international relations at the University of Edinburgh. And he's helping young Ukrainians in Glasgow to stay connected to their roots through St. Mary's Ukrainian School, a project that he co-founded in 2024.
We have established the first Ukrainian academic school, St. Mary's Ukrainian School, Glasgow. So where we try to preserve and to save our language, our liturgy, our culture, our music and traditions. It's an amazing opportunity for children to get certified according to the Minister of Education of Ukraine. And whenever they come back to Ukraine, they'll be able to get to the class according to their age. So I mentor teenagers aged from 13 to 16 while they are in their final years of high school to help them just to pursue their exams and to get to the universities. We are the first Ukrainian academic school in Scotland because there are 14 branches of the school in London and we are first in Scotland. We got lessons every Saturday of the months. We have the drama class, got the speech development class. All students, they are able to perform as a choir. It's named Volja. Volja in English means freedom. We got Yalriv painting, traditional Yalriv toy, which is in the UNESCO heritage. So it is made out of the natural wood and painted with green, yellow, red and white. And they're just amazing. So it works as an art therapy for children. While they paint, they can speak and share their thoughts, their expressions and their emotions. Because we know that a lot of children got trauma, got PTSD because of the war, because of the rockets, because of our alarm. And that's a place where we try to recover them from that condition and to give them hope. I had an opportunity to speak in the chambers of the Scottish Parliament about youth in Ukraine, and I had an opportunity just to spread awareness about marginalized communities whether it's at the university level or it's national level. So we are doing a lot of training for young people just to know what are the human rights and how we can support these people whose human rights are really abused. And as we know, the situation over the last 3 years, it's really and really bad for our people, as a lot of civilians has died and a lot of young people has died, whether they're volunteering or whether just staying in their homes, as nobody knows when the rocket would come to their house. Rockets flying over hospitals, schools, kindergarten, and basically everywhere. We are young leaders and we are here for the future without violence, without conflicts, and without wars. I'm really grateful to all of the people in Scotland who shared their homes, shared their hearts to Ukrainians. What keeps me going is basically the smiles of the children when they get some good grade or when they get to the university. And I see that I planted the seed in their life and basically just growing into a big tree of success. And it's a great place at St. Mary's Ukrainian School just to support those children. You know, the educational system is always hard. It was hard for me because I had to do two schools, so Scottish and Ukrainian at the same time. And now I get to the University of Edinburgh. And by showing my example, I can show that everything is possible. You just need to believe in yourself.
That was 19-year-old Nazrie Leeluk, Ukrainian refugee, Scottish youth parliamentarian and educational advocate in that, our penultimate episode of Laura Kabelka's Age is Just a Number series. And continuing the theme of cultural cross-pollination, our next story is about a new museum to the British romantic poet George Gordon Byron, better known as Lord Byron, 1788 to 1824. Only the museum's not in the UK, it's in Italy. In Ravenna, to be precise, for which, as we will be finding out, there are very good biographical reasons. Indeed, when Danny Mitzman visited the museum, she was soon told that she was in good company, arriving hot on the heels of none other than Britain's royal couple themselves, King Charles and Queen Camilla.
It was a splendid day. After the more official reception in the courtyard with speeches, we read some Byron in English and in Italian.
Diego Saglia is an English literature professor at the University of Parma, the vice president of the Italian Byron Society, a member of the Byron Museum's advisory committee, and a master of royal gossip.
Professore, abbiamo solo 5 minuti, only 5 minutes, not 10 minutes. It turned into a quarter of an hour. I think we were in there almost forever because she wouldn't stop asking questions.
I reckon Diego's been dining out on tales of the royal visit since April, and I too am lucky enough to have him as my guide.
We're in the courtyard of Palazzo Guiccioli, the palace where Byron came to live. The palace had been empty for at least 20 years or something like that. And this was a complete tip, basically. It was a very bedraggled courtyard. It was also a military installation during World War II. This was where the Nazi commanders had their own headquarters when Italy was occupied. In that position there, where the bookshop is and the ticket office now, that was where they kept the weapons and all the explosives. It was also, after the war, turned into the officers' club for the local Italian army, so it hadn't been looked after.
It took over 10 years to restore the palazzo, which takes its name from the man who bought it at the beginning of the 1800s, Count Alessandro Guiccioli.
He was the richest man in town and in the region and in the area. Ravenna at the time was part of the state of the church. So the king was the pope and Count Guiccioli was one of his vassals, basically. And this was probably the grandest aristocratic palace in Ravenna. And he also prepared it as a residence for the woman he married later, Teresa Gamba. And now let's go in the footsteps of the Queen. This is the opening room, the welcoming room of the museum, where the theme is Byron's journeys. So here the visitor is supposed to get an idea of how Byron left England and how he ended up in Ravenna. And as you can see from that map there that is being projected, that's the journey he took. So here you get an idea of the trip.
And over here, when you come in on the left, you have the three portraits of the three protagonists.
You have the three protagonists. You have the husband, the wife, and the lover. The Count, the Countess, and Byron himself. Here you can listen to Byron. So if you sit on those armchairs, you can listen to two poems by Byron. One a very comic one a very tragic one. Byron had these two sides to his personality and his poetry as well.
What if thy deep and ample stream should be a mirror of my heart, where she may read the thousand thoughts I now betray to thee, wild as thy wave and headlong as thy speed?
These two rooms are occupied by Byron. We know that that one was his bedroom, and that this one was the place where he wrote. This was his study.
Byron had been living in Venice, which is where he'd met the newlywed Teresa and where the intriguing Ravenna chapter began.
Lady, if for the cold and cloudy clime where I was born...
Byron was fascinated by this beautiful, intelligent woman who came from Ravenna, the place where Dante was buried, the place where the story of Paolo and Francesca, from the first of the cantos, had a very important part, and also a woman who could talk about Dante and who could quote snippets of Dante to him.
Such charms displayed, so sweet a language from so fair a mouth. Ah, to what effort would it not persuade?
The spark was there, basically, right from the start. Up until that time in Venice, he'd had all sorts of liaisons, attachments, a little bit like Don Giovanni in Mozart's opera. So meeting Teresa really meant a complete transformation, and it was sentimentally, emotionally, sexually, but also culturally very much. And so at the end of the year, in December, he decides to up sticks and come to Ravenna, lock, stock and barrel. We even have the bill of lading of his furniture, of his animals, shipped by sea from Venice all the way down to here. So he brought his bed and this and that and the other. And he became a tenant of Count Wycherley, the husband, at the same time, while he was by now the lover of the wife.
Did the husband know what was going on?
The husband. Okay. Certainly he knew that there was some kind of relationship between the wife and the poet, but probably his idea was that it was a very conventional cavalier servente type of relationship. That is to say, Byron was the man who was approved by the husband, who would accompany the wife to the opera, to the conversaciones, to, you know, all sorts of social gatherings when the husband could not be bothered. But it was also in his interest not to know, because it was in the Count's interest to have someone like Byron around. Byron, at this point in time, was an international celebrity. He was the poet most read, translated, talked about. He was also a scandalous figure, of course, but he brought a lot of prestige with himself.
As with much of Byron's life story, you really couldn't make it up. And the museum offers visitors an enchantingly immersive, interactive experience to discover many fascinating details.
This room, which is more multimedia than anything, you get exposed to Byron's fame during his life. So he became a celebrity, became an icon. His face was reproduced countless times, basically on everything, busts, crockery, jewellery. And then the videos talk to you about music inspired by Byron, paintings inspired by him, all the way to the 20th century. So this is the room dedicated to what is called Byromania, which, funnily enough, is a term invented by his ex-wife, who basically hated him. This is a travelling case. It was one of Teresa's wedding gifts. Ironically, although it's meant to commemorate the wedding with Count Guiccioli, later in life, Teresa emptied it and she started using it to keep all her Byronic souvenirs. So instead of commemorating the wedding and the marriage, it commemorated probably the real love story of her life. She started keeping everything, letters, locks of hair, jewels, her manuscript of the life of Lord Byron that she wrote in French till the end of her life. So she really saw herself as a preserver of Byron's memories. The man changed her life. Also, she took trips to Britain, and she would go and gather, collect all kinds of souvenirs that she could to enrich her treasure trove.
Ironic that this treasure trove's now housed in the marital home she abandoned to follow Byron. Nevertheless, it seems the perfect place because, says the man with all the gossip, Byron was truly happy here.
Ravenna was good for him. He wrote an incredible amount when he was here. Poetry, plays, all sorts of things. Probably what mattered to him about being in this building and being with around this kind of very peculiar setup was that he felt part of a family. He felt really grounded here, although it was complicated because everything about Byron is complicated. Yeah.
For DW in Ravenna, a far less complicated Danny Mitzman.
We are indebted to Byron expert Professor Gregory Dowling for the lovely renditions of the poet's words that you heard in Danny Mitzman's report, and indeed to Danny herself for proving that, though her student days may be behind her, she still knows how to twist a professor's arm. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Our final story this week comes to us courtesy of our partners at GBH's The World. It's a weird and wonderful tale, so I will give you the basic facts straight up and then let reporter Duri Buscarin take it from there. For more than five decades, a group of Orthodox monks has occupied a medieval monastery on Greece's Mount Athos, defying court orders and church authorities who say that they have no right to be there. The standoff, rooted in a theological split dating back to the 1970s, has turned violent at times and drawn in the Greek state. Curious to find out more? So were we.
On May 22nd, a Greek Orthodox monk went out to work in a flowerbed. According to monastic authorities, two men from a rival monastery came up from behind him and attacked him with garden tools. The victim was hospitalized, but later released. Archon Elias Damianakis calls it a murder attempt.
These people have taken a military approach to securing their existence there. And it's really frightening.
Damianakis is an iconographer, or religious painter, for the Greek Orthodox Church. While the accused monastery claimed the attack was faked, Damianakis says it's the latest in a string of events between two rival brotherhoods that claim ownership of Isphigmenou Monastery.
No monk owns a monastery. Even the abbots, they don't own it. They take care of it.
The two brotherhoods live side by side. One is recognized by the Greek Orthodox Church and lives in a small section of the monastery still under their control, creating a situation that is ripe for conflict.
They share a wall, So they could be sitting back to back. The wall is there, and the legitimate brotherhood is suffering under very limited and confined living conditions.
The Esfigmenou Monastery is part of Mount Athos, an autonomous holy mountain of some 20 monastic communities, as significant to Orthodox Greeks as Vatican City for Catholics. The monastery is this hulking 10th century structure on the shore of the Aegean Sea. Famous saints have come from there.
It's a treasury, a repository of Christianity's inheritance. And when you go to Mount Athos, you see paintings from the 8th century, 9th century, all the way to contemporary, a nonstop chain of constant tradition.
Until the schism of Esfigmenou. The brotherhood that currently occupies the monastery declined an interview, but you can see glimpses of their lives through their TikTok account.
They just want to do their own thing, to pray, and pray in their own way, and they don't want to be bothered.
John Rigas acts as spokesperson for the brotherhood. He says that in 1972, the monks of Esfigmenou broke away from the Greek Orthodox Church and decided to no longer honor its patriarch. They were upset that the church had changed to the modern Gregorian calendar in use today, and they opposed Greek Orthodox leaders, reforging ties with the Catholic Church.
That calendar was the main issue. Why? Because it splits the church. It divides the church.
Rigas says the monastery belongs to the monks who live there, and they have proof.
Every monastery on Mount Athos has its own document, its own deeds, let's put it that way, for the monastery. The deeds from the 1400s. And they own the monastery, the brotherhood.
After declaring the monks of Esfigmenou were no longer part of the church, Greek Orthodox leaders began trying to evict them from the building through the Greek court system. Since then, Rigas says, life there has been full of daily injustices.
They turned their electricity off, and they turned it off because they say they don't need it. Well, they don't need the electricity anyway. They have candles.
Rigas claims church leaders have seized the monks' mail, including their social security checks, that it pressures supply trucks not to go to Esfigmenou, forcing the brothers to carry in food on their backs. When they go fishing in the waters in front of the monastery, church authorities call the Coast Guard. Even seeing a doctor is hard.
They can't go to a doctor. Doctors can't come in. If they find out they're coming to go to Esfigmenou, they won't let them in, you know.
The leadership of the Greek Orthodox Church in Istanbul, known as the Ecumenical Patriarchate, did not respond to multiple requests for comment on these allegations. After Greek courts refused to evict the monks, police have made repeated attempts to seize the monastery. They were pushed back by Esfigmenou monks throwing stones and Molotov cocktails. For now, the standoff continues. On a recent visit to Mount Athos, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis appeared to reference the conflict, saying the Greek government would stand by the Orthodox Church on Mount Athos and announcing a 100 million euro assistance package for monastery maintenance. But supporters like Elias Damianakis fear the clock is ticking and that the brotherhood that controls the building is selling off religious art and relics to pay the bills.
And the Greek government is really obligated, required to protect the peninsula, and they're failing to do so. They're failing to fulfill their constitutional duties.
He says it's a humiliation for the monastery's ownership to remain unresolved. For The World, I'm Derry Biscarin.
Our thanks to our partners at The World for permission to share Duri's report with you. Find The World wherever you get your podcasts. Us too, of course. And thank you so much for all your likes and reviews. They are far more important to us than you might think. This programme was produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineers were Ilias Katsamakis and Gerd Georgi. Our feedback address is inside-europe@dw.com. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.